Hi there, it's hour number two of Catholic Answers Live, and I am Jerry Usher, honored to be back in the host chair. I was the founding host of the program back in 1998. Boy, it's been on the air, Jimmy, over 21 years.
Can you imagine that? Yeah, how about that?
You've been there the whole time.
Right, I was there on day one with you.
And you're still young.
Likewise.
Thank you. I'm Jerry Usher, in for Cy Kellett. I did move on in 2009, continued hosting Catholic Radio Fun Drives, and still do a little bit of that, and co-host, Take Two with Jerry and Debbie, heard on most of these EWTN affiliates at noon Eastern Time and replay at midnight Eastern Time. So I hope that you can tune in and join us for that. But Jimmy Akin is here. He is the senior apologist at Catholic Answers and answering your questions. Tuesdays for many, many years have been devoted to questions by you and answers by the apologists here. So, Jimmy, no need to waste any more time, right? We got some people from last hour. You're all set?
I'm all set.
Okay, thank you. Everybody held on through the last hour. That's great. John in Superior, Wisconsin is first watching on Facebook Live. Hi, John. You are on with Jimmy Akin. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing? I hope everyone can hear me.
Just fine.
Well, my question has a lot to do with the Fraternity of Freemasonry.
Okay.
My understanding has been that the Catholic Church and the Fraternity of Freemasonry has had an adversarial relationship with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering on why does that adversarial relationship exist? Now, I have heard, I just want to go into some detail, if that's okay.
Briefly.
I have heard things that, yes, sir. I've heard some things like Freemasons apparently initiated the French Revolution. I've heard things like Freemasons were allegedly the sworn enemy of the Catholic Church. I can find no evidence back this up historically, mm-hmm. but I've heard a lot of Catholics tell me these things,
mm-hmm.
and I go, does the historical record support this? So, thank you.
So, I appreciate your thoughtfulness on this question. There is kind of a rumor net that exists around basically every secret society. And one of the reasons for that is because the societies are secret. If you have a group, whether it's Freemasonry or the Loyal Order of Odd Fellows or the Ku Klux Klan or whoever it may be, the fact that they are a secret society and don't open up their meetings to just everybody and don't let people see what they do in private and don't keep and publish records of what everything they're up to, that is just going to generate rumors. And so consequently, some of the rumors in any given case are going to be true. Some of them are going to be false. And personally, like you, John, I have a rather low tolerance for poorly sourced rumors. There's a lot of sensationalism out there on a whole bunch of topics. And I very much do not favor it when people just hear a claim and run with it without checking to see whether, just because it feeds their narrative, without checking to see do the facts actually support it or not. So I'm not going to be making claims that I have not checked out about Freemasonry. I am aware of a lot of these claims regarding it in history. What I can say and what I have checked out to some degree anyway is regardless of particular situations, there have been situations in which Freemasonry members of the Masonic movement more broadly have apparently taken an adversarial role toward the church and have tried to undermine the church's role in society. This manifests differently in different countries and in different times. Freemasonry is not always as members of the Masonic movement are not always as hostile to the Catholic Church as they are in some places at some times. Here in America, at least in recent times, in the last 50 years, let's say, most American Masons have been relatively friendly towards Catholics and would even say, hey, yeah, no, I don't have a problem with Catholics. If you're a Catholic, you could join our lodge. Well, that may be their attitude. It's not necessarily the church's attitude, because even in situations where Masonry is not actively working to subvert the role of the church in society. It has a problem in that its religious views are not in line with Catholic teaching. One of the things that Freemasonry tends to advocate is a position known as indifferentism. Indifferentism is a fancy word that's used in Catholic circles to refer to the idea that God is indifferent to what religion you are, that it doesn't matter to God what religion you are. And that's something that that a Christian and certainly anyone who's a Catholic should have a problem with, because Jesus indicates that what religion we are does matter to God. It doesn't mean that other people who aren't our religion don't worship God or that God isn't able to give his grace to them. He can, they do, and he does. But it is still something that's important to God, which is why he bothered to send us the prophets and to send us his son in the first place, because he cares about what our religion is. And so he sent us the prophets and he sent us Jesus to inform our religion. Well, that understanding is frequently not present in Masonic circles. And so even if a given Masonic lodge might not be subversive towards the church in a let's go get those Catholics sense, it is subversive to the church in the sense of it's teaching an idea, namely indifferentism, that's in conflict with Catholic teaching. And this is related to Freemasonry's origins in what's known as the Enlightenment, which was a movement back in the 1700s that wanted to remove the church from the social position it had and the kind of influence it had in society at the time. And Enlightenment values were part of the French Revolution. They were also part of the American Revolution, though to a lesser degree. And you had people like Voltaire, a French philosopher, and other people who really did not like Christianity and did not like the church and wanted to reduce their influence in society. And so those overall Enlightenment values tended to influence Freemasonry, especially in the beginning and especially in some places, but the movement has become more diverse over the course of time to where, as I've indicated, it's not every Freemason is actively trying to subvert the church. But there are still ideas in Freemasonry that don't line up either with Christianity or with the Catholic faith in particular.
I have an additional question. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, real
yeah,
quick.
What's your question?
Isn't it true that the bishops of Rome have introduced papal bulls or encyclicals, I can't recall which, specifically condemning Freemasonry? That would be my final question. Isn't it true that the popes of Rome have...
There have been a number of papal documents, including encyclicals, where popes have said, here are some problems with Freemasonry. The most recent documents, if you want the current state of affairs, haven't actually been issued by popes, but by a department at the Vatican called the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And the easy way to find those documents is if you just go online and search for Freemasonry and the word Ratzinger, R-A-T-Z-I-N-G-E-R, Ratzinger, because he was the head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith at the time those documents were issued back in the 1980s.
All right. Thank you, John, for joining us here on Catholic Answers Live. Second hour of our Tuesday Q&A open forum program with Jimmy Akin, serving your needs here with the faith questions and answers for 2 hours. We have Tom and Jada and Michael and Chrissy and William. We're going to get to all of you here on the program. But I just want to pause for a quick second and give you an opportunity, give you information about how you can really get on board with Catholic Answers and get involved with a very, very, I think, beautiful, beautiful project. Wouldn't it be fascinating to learn what the very first Christians believed? Many of you have probably studied the Church Fathers. And you hear it talked about a lot here on Catholic Answers Live. But did you know that we have early Christian writings that are even older than some of the books of the New Testament? And there's a wealth of information from the earliest Christian writers that provides vital information about our faith. And that's why the man you're listening to, Jimmy Akin, and the Catholic Answers staff have just launched a new campaign to teach people about the very first fathers. Jimmy, why is this important for us to know what the what we call the Church Fathers wrote and talked about?
Well, the Church Fathers are the link between us and the world of the Bible. You know, Christian history didn't stop when the last book of the New Testament was written. And the age of the Church Fathers didn't start when the last book of the Bible was written. The two ages overlapped. And this is something that a lot of people are not aware of. They're not aware of the wealth of early Christian writings that we have from this period. And so that's why I wanted to do this audio set of the very first fathers to help people learn more about this period where the age of the apostles was blending into the age of the fathers, so that you have a variety of writings that were written by Christians during the period that the New Testament was written and in the years immediately after the New Testament was written. And I cover not only more familiar documents in this, like the letter of Clement of Rome, one of the first popes, to the Corinthians. I do cover that, but I also cover other things that not as many people have heard about. Like, I cover a first century private revelation that a lot of people have not heard about. I talk about a first century hymn book that we actually have, hymns that the Christians were singing in the first century. And I talk about a number of pivotal figures in the history of theology and the light that they shed, even from these very early days, on the development of Christian doctrine.
All right. So, dear friends, you just heard a little snippet, just a sampling of what is on this project from Catholic Answers. The Apostolic Fathers are absolutely fascinating. I remember even in my own faith walk, 30-some years ago, reading William Juergens on the Church Fathers and how important that was to really strengthen, the bolster the foundation of my Catholic faith. I actually had friends who were encouraging me to consider fundamentalism and evangelicalism, and as beautiful as those people are and the faith that they hold, I was born and raised a Catholic, and I was being a little bit swayed. And so the Church Fathers were so important for me. So strengthen your faith and get involved with this project. Visit Catholic.com, and there's a banner right there, Very First Fathers. See the Very First Fathers banner, and you can get involved in this project and learn the Church Fathers and help others do the same. You can find out more about that again at Catholic.com. And more of your questions for Jimmy Akin are straight ahead.
Catholic Answers Live. We're waiting for your call.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I love listening to Catholic radio. It's perfect. It provides peace and it builds us up and strengthens us. We listen to it whenever we're in the car. My husband and I love it. He got me started with it before he even became a Catholic. He owns his own business, and so he's working by himself, and he listened to Catholic radio, and he's called in several times too. It's using the technology that we have for good.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Right back to your questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. Again, Tom in New York, thanks for your patience, sir, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Welcome, Tom. You're on with Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. I was just wondering why so many prominent Catholic apologists are converts like yourself, like Tim Staples, David Anders, Scott Hahn, Steve Ray. Mm-hmm. Is it because it come from more of a Bible-based tradition that... Or is it more because being a convert requires you to defend the faith, kind of?
I would say it's a couple of things. First, though, I want to give credit to all of the apologists who are not converts, because sometimes people who are converts kind of get some extra attention, and I want to make sure that apologists who are cradle Catholics, like Carl Keating and Scott Hahn and Carlo Broussard and all those folks.
Not Scott. Scott's a convert.
I'm sorry?
I think you said Scott. Scott Hahn.
No, I said Carl Keating, Carlo Broussard, and Patrick Madrid. If I said
okay.
Scott Hahn, I was
mistaken.
I must
have misheard you, Jimmy. Sorry about
I
that.
I may have misspoken. In any event, I was thinking Patrick Madrid. So I want to give credit to those who are cradle Catholics. And it's not just them. There have been others all throughout history, and there are many others today. I do think it's accurate to say that that there is a higher proportion of professional apologists who are converts than the overall number of Catholics who are converts. So I think they are represented more strongly. And I think the reason for that has to do with the process of conversion. If you're someone who is changing from one position to another intellectually, you either prior to your conversion have firm convictions or you don't. If you don't have firm convictions prior to your conversion, then your conversion may not be a particularly intellectual one. There are some people who are kind of, yeah, I didn't really have firm beliefs and then I became Catholic and I still don't have overly firm beliefs. But then there are other people who do have firm beliefs. And so if you're a firm believer in some other viewpoint prior to becoming a Catholic, then you don't just become Catholic on the spur of the moment. You have to work your way through the arguments for why the Catholic position rather than the position you started with. And in that process of working through those arguments, whether they're biblical or philosophical or historical or whatever they may be, in the process of working through the arguments and counterarguments, you end up giving yourself a background in how to defend the Catholic faith. And it's natural, having done that, to then say, wow, you know, I've become convinced of the Catholic position. I've learned all this stuff about how to defend it. Let's see how we can use this to serve God. And so I think there's kind of a natural path for people who have been something other than Catholic and been very firmly committed and who then work their way through the arguments for the Catholic faith to then turn around and try to employ those apologetically in one way or another, either professionally or just on a personal level.
Excellent.
Tom?
Okay. Yeah, so I was just wondering if you might know the percentage of people who are converts by conviction, like intellectual converts into the faith versus a convert by expediency in terms of marriage.
I don't have any specific numbers on those. My impression is that most people, and this is unfortunate, but this is just due to human nature in its fallen condition. Most people who convert, my sense is that most people who convert from one position to another, regardless of what position they're converting from or to, are motivated by things other than intellectual arguments. I think that a lot of it is, well, if someone becomes a Catholic or becomes a Mormon or becomes an evangelical or becomes an atheist, it's because frequently they want to marry one or something like that.
Okay, Tom. Thanks for your call from New York. We appreciate that very much. 888-318-7884. Second hour of our Tuesday question and answer program coming to you from Catholic Answers Live. And Jada is next for Jimmy Akin. Hi, Jada. Thanks for waiting. You waited a long time, too. We appreciate that. Welcome.
Yeah. Jada, you're on the air. What's your question?
Hello, Jada. Are you
Jada
there?
May not be listening to us at the moment.
Yeah, maybe we can put Jada back on hold there, and we'll try Michael in Houston. Yeah.
By the way, I think Jada may be a first-time caller. It's important to let folks know, once you are on hold, you want to listen to your phone, not the radio, because you'll hear us on your phone first before it has a chance to go out to the networks and be heard over your radio.
Yeah, it's called a broadcast delay. So we're going to check with Jada and see if Jada is there. Michael, in the meantime, is next in Houston, listening on Guadalupe Radio Network. Hi, Michael.
Hi. My question has to deal with something that I've heard, so I want to know, is it actually something the church teaches, mm-hmm. and if it's true? I've heard that before the second coming of Christ, that the Jews will be converted, or something to that effect. And so is that actually a Catholic teaching? And if it is, what does it exactly mean?
Okay. There is a passage in Romans. You want to look at St. Paul's letter to the Romans. It's in chapters 9 to 11, where he has an extended discussion of the role of both Jews and Gentiles in God's providential plan of the ages. And in the course of that discussion, he indicates that many Jewish people did not accept Jesus, and this was something that was in accord with God's plan because it would lead to an opportunity for Gentiles to come to the true God, for non-Jewish people to come to the God of Israel and become followers of him through his son Jesus. And he indicates, though, that this is just a temporary state of affairs, that eventually Jewish people will turn back to God and be accepted again. And he says, well, what will that mean if their rejection, when they turned away from Jesus, meant life for the world, what will their acceptance bring but life from the dead? And so he seems to link the conversion of the Jewish people to Christ to the resurrection of the dead or to the end of the world. So there is historically an understanding in Catholic circles and other Christian circles that there will be some kind of significant conversion of Jewish individuals prior to the end of the world. Exactly what that means is something people have differed over. There are some people who would say, well, it's going to be every single Jewish person alive at the end of the world is going to become a Christian, and then Jesus will come back. Well, maybe, but if you look at the way Paul is using his language here in Romans 9 to 11, he's talking in approximate terms because not every Jew rejected Christ. Paul himself was a Jew, and he accepted Christ. So did the other apostles. So did many of their converts who were Jewish. And so it wasn't in the first century that all Jews rejected Christ, just a large number of them did. And so consequently, when he talks about their turning back to Christ before the end of the world, he may not mean all of them, just a large number of them. And so we can't really in advance quantify exactly how big this event is going to be in terms of how many people will convert or not. That's something we have to leave to God. But we do have an indication here that there will be some kind of significant conversion of Jewish individuals to the Christian faith prior to the end of the world. And that's something that the Catechism of the Catholic Church mentions briefly in its section on the end of the world. So it is part of church teaching. There have been people of various perspectives who have tried to find other interpretations of this passage, but this is the one that has been the majority interpretation down through history, and it's also one that is officially endorsed by the Catholic Church today.
Okay, Michael?
Yeah, sounds great. Now I've got to go and read Romans, but thank you very much. God bless you guys.
You too.
All right. God bless you, Michael. William is next in Virginia, listening to Catholic Answers Live on Sirius XM 130. Hi, William. You're on with Jimmy Akin.
Good afternoon, gentlemen, and thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I was inspired by a previous caller to call, and it's a question regarding marriage.
Okay. Just so you know, William, we're real close to our hard break. So what's your question?
Okay. If two lapsed Catholics marry mm-hmm. in a civil marriage
uh-huh.
and then come back to the church and become faithful Catholics,
mm-hmm.
My understanding is they're not to receive the Eucharist, but and if not, what must they do to be eligible for
okay.
receiving the sacrament?
In essence, the standard things that need to be done are that, well, they both need to go to confession, and they also need to have their marriage convalidated. That's the technical term. You also hear about it being discussed as having their marriage blessed. But basically, it means having a simple ceremony where you renew your vows. It doesn't need to be a big thing. It's typically not done in the context of a mass. It's just a priest and the parties and a couple of witnesses at least. And so that will that will supply the ceremony that's needed for them to be married to each other and allow them to continue living as man and wife and receiving the sacraments in that condition. So basically, it's go to confession and have your marriage blessed. And you can just talk to someone at your parish, call the church secretary. They handle these situations all the time. Just say you're interested in having your marriage blessed, and they can help you from there. If there are complicating factors, like maybe one person has been married to someone else before, and so there's been a divorce, there may need to be additional steps, like you may need to apply for an annulment or things like that. But one way or another, there are always ways to handle the situation, and just rejoice that God is leading you back to the church and trust him and work through it one step at a time.
All right, William, thank you for the call and good advice from Jimmy. We'll be praying for you along that journey. We appreciate you joining us. Benjamin, Mark, William, and Zeke are up next here on Catholic Answers Live. We do have a phone line that is open. Any question is okay today on our Tuesday Q&A open forum program, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is here to give the answers. I'm Jerry Usher in for Cy Kellett, and we will continue in just a minute.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture's moral center continues to fly apart, and with every form of deviance publicly aired and celebrated, we have no choice but to equip our kids to understand about such issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. Silence can no longer be an option. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging on to the shop at Catholic.com.
Just like the saints of the Counter-Reformation, our own souls are in constant need of reform, of reconversion to God and His will for us. We struggle with sin. We become distracted in prayer. We find it hard to be loving and easy to be selfish. In Reform Yourself, Sean McAfee shows you how these magnificent saints can be guides to your own personal transformation. We all need to reform our souls. Let the saints who reformed the church show you how. Order your copy of Reform Yourself today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Dr. David Anders. Do you have questions about the Catholic faith? Get the answers on Call to Communion tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Tuesdays mean your questions and Catholic answers. You always get Catholic answers on the program, but on Tuesdays and Thursdays, it's an open forum. You set the table with your questions, whatever they happen to be. And the next one comes from Benjamin in Indiana, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Greetings, Benjamin. We're glad you called.
Thank you. I am a soon-to-be convert to the Catholic Church, and I'm married with 3 kids.
Uh-huh. Congratulations on both.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, this time I'm the only one coming to the Catholic Church, but that leads to my question, which is the priest told me I'm still allowed to attend with my family at their Protestant church.
Mm-hmm.
I just, obviously, it doesn't count as my Sunday obligation, and I can't take communion there, which I understand all that. But the question I have is, I currently participate in the praise team playing acoustic guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question was what the church's stance on me participating in that moving forward, and that's really my question. So
okay. So in term, do you sing in addition to playing the guitar, or do you just play the guitar?
I always say I play the guitar so I don't have to sing. So no, I don't sing.
Okay. So the church doesn't have a specific canon law that addresses this issue. What it does have is a canon law that says we need to maintain communion with the church even in our patterns of daily activity. And so that means we need to not do things that would be directly contrary to the Catholic faith. In terms of something like this, there's been a long tradition because not everybody has musical talent. There's been a long tradition going back centuries of hiring musicians in one church or another without a strict regard for are they a member of our communion. So if you're in a – if let's say you're in a town somewhere and in Europe in the 1800s and there's no Catholic in your area who's a qualified organist, well, you might hire a Protestant to be your organist as long as the Protestant doesn't have a problem with it. Because even though he's not a Catholic, he, you know, if he's willing to recognize Catholics as fellow Christians and recognize that their worship of God is legitimate and he's willing to support it by playing an organ, then that's something that is fine. And so you find a lot of actual classical composers who have written Catholic liturgical music. Because there was this recognition that their fellow Christians and their worship of God is legitimate and so forth. Well, the Catholic Church recognizes the same thing about our separated brethren. They are our brethren in Christ. They are fellow Christians. They are worshiping God. Their worship is legitimate. They should be worshiping God. Now, we would go further and say, well, it would be even better if they were worshiping God in the Catholic Church. But it's nevertheless true that they are worshiping God and that pleases God. If there are problems with a particular act of worship, like let's say there's a particular hymn that includes a false theological idea, well, one wouldn't want to sing that line. But it wouldn't stop one in principle from singing the parts of the hymn that are all theologically true. And it wouldn't so as long as you're not being required to do something that is itself wrong, then it's not going to be a problem for from a moral Catholic moral theology point of view for you to continue to do this, especially if it has a salutary effect or helpful effect on your own family, showing them that that you honor their Christianity even though you feel that they, you know, that one should be a Catholic. They can deduce that from the fact you become a Catholic. And so if this is a gesture that would help maintain good family relations and maybe eventually encourage them to become Catholic, then it would be something that you would certainly be able to do.
Great. That's actually what I'm hoping. So I appreciate the answer. And you guys have been a big part of my conversion. Listen to you guys for the past 2 years. I'm part of that statistic where Jimmy said a lot of people convert from Protestantism to Catholicism. It's not like a quick thing. It's something we think through and sort through. And I asked salvation, and that was a big part of my final decision. So awesome. I definitely appreciate your guys' ministry and what you guys do.
Well, thank you so much, Benjamin, and welcome home.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll continue to pray for you along the way and that the grace that God is giving you will work through you with your entire family. I think you can probably pretty much count on that happening. Mark is in Houston. He's got us on the iHeartRadio app. Hello, Mark. This is Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin. What can we do for you?
Hey, guys. Yeah, Jimmy, you had I had a question for you. You had mentioned one time you were a fan, I think, of Blaise Pascal.
Mm-hmm.
And my question was, in his Pensées, he makes several statements that sounds like he's got some kind of issue with the Jesuits. And I was just curious. I never knew why. I was curious if you could answer that.
Yeah. So Pascal was a member of a movement in the Catholic Church in his day that was known as Jansenism. Jansenism sprang from the writings of a bishop theologian named Cornelius Jansen, who had a very Calvinistic understanding of predestination and grace and the way they work. And he published after his death, one of his books was published called Augustinus. And this book caused a theological controversy, which led the Pope to intervene. And the Pope at the time indicated that actually some of the things that Jansen had said were heretical, that they were contrary to divine revelation that had been infallibly defined by the Catholic Church. And consequently, this led to further controversy. The Jansenists said, well, if you understood it this way, it would be heretical, but that's really not what Jansen meant. And then the Pope came back and said, well, actually, this is exactly what it says in the book. So what the book says is heretical. And it took a while for the controversy to play out. During the controversy, the Jesuits took the Pope's side against the Jansenists. And since Pascal was a Jansenist, he naturally was looking for ways to argue back against the defenders of the Pope's position and try to find ways to argue that, no, Jansen really was Orthodox and so forth. And there were other issues that got brought into the whole subject, not just predestination and grace, but other things, including dueling and usury and stuff like that. The place, if you want to read about this in Pascal's writings, is if you want to read where he really gets into this, it's not in Pensées. It's in his what are called his provincial letters. And so you might get a copy of the provincial letters and look at them, or just look up provincial letters on Wikipedia and it'll have a summary of what the issues were.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's great to know. Thank you. I appreciate I never knew. I'd always thought his theology was pretty sound as far as we knew, but I didn't know he had some issues.
He had some issues. I mean, he was a great thinker and made important contributions to mathematics and to apologetics, but he wasn't perfect in everything.
All right, Mark, glad we could help you with that. We're going to go to William next, also a Catholic Answers Live app listener in New Jersey. Hi, William. You're on with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you guys for the show. It's a great show.
Thank you.
So I'm looking for some help, Jimmy, because my brother-in-law has been listening to this Protestant pastor, Les Feldwick, I think Feldick, so I don't know if you know him. But
I'm not familiar with him.
Okay, so he apparently reads the Bible and has his own interpretation. So what my brother-in-law is confused about now, he's Catholic. He's confused because this person is teaching that Paul was a Gentile so Paul was apostle to the Gentiles,
mm-hmm.
and that he had a different gospel for the Gentiles, and this is a different gospel than Peter had.
Ooh.
Which to me doesn't make any sense because it should be just one gospel. But
right.
So I didn't know if there was any material that I can show, because he's a very analytical person. I'd like to give him some material that says, no, it's all one gospel, no matter who taught it. But so I don't know if you can help me with that.
Yeah, so where some of this is coming from is a passage in Galatians, Paul's letter to the Galatians, where he notes that that the same spirit that worked powerfully in Peter for evangelizing Jews also worked powerfully in Paul for evangelizing Gentiles. And so that's where that passage influences a lot of people in characterizing Paul as, quote unquote, the apostle to the Gentiles and Peter as the apostle to the Jews. But the New Testament never uses those phrases. It never says Paul is the apostle to the Gentile or Peter is the apostle to the Jews. It just notes that they had different levels of effectiveness in reaching particular audiences. And in fact, if you look at what the book of Acts records, it indicates that both Peter and Paul had prominent roles in evangelizing both groups. So for example, if you look in one of Paul's later accounts of his conversion, I think this is the one in Acts 26, he says that Jesus sent him to the people, meaning the Jewish people, and also to the Gentiles. And so that's borne out by what we see in his evangelistic practices earlier in Acts. He'll first start preaching in a synagogue, and then if he encounters problems, he'll start preaching to Gentiles as well. But he always includes the Jews in his message, and in fact, he makes prominent Jewish converts in different places, like Lydia at Philippi, who was a Jewish woman who dealt in indigo. So he makes Jewish converts. He always includes the Jews in his evangelization, but he happened to have a special kind of success among Gentiles. So he ministered to both groups. In the same way, St. Peter, he obviously ministered very successfully to Jews, but God also chose Peter to convert the household of Cornelius in Acts chapter 10. And he refers back to this in Acts chapter 15, where he talks about how you, other Jewish Christians here in Jerusalem, know that God made a choice among us that it was by my mouth that the Gentiles would hear the gospel. And so Peter also ministered not just to Jews, among whom he did have notable success, but also to Gentiles. And so consequently, you can't look at Peter and Paul as if they were exclusively ministering to one group or the other. And that means that you have to recognize that they were sharing the same gospel with both groups. It's not like Paul had one message for Jews and a different contradictory message for Gentiles. There was one gospel for everybody, the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's why when we hear about the gospel in the New Testament, it's in the singular, the gospel, not the gospels, plural. Later on, when the term became a plural, it began to refer to particular documents, but not to the fundamental message. The fundamental message is always singular, the gospel, the good news of Jesus. And one passage in particular, to loop back to where we began with the epistle to the Galatians, one passage in particular that demonstrates that is right there at the beginning of Galatians, because some of the people that who were Gentile that Paul had converted in Galatia were starting to get the idea that they needed to be circumcised in order to be Christians and be saved. And Paul is adamant with them, that is not the gospel that you were presented with, and there's only the one gospel. And if anybody else, even if it were me, or even if it were an angel from heaven, he says, preached another gospel to you, cut them off. Do not listen to them. And so he's emphatic that there is only one gospel and that Jews and Gentiles likewise are saved by faith in Jesus. That's a point he also stresses in Romans, if you want to look, for example, at Romans 1 through 3, especially the end of chapter 3.
All right, William, hope that that helps. We are kind of on a time crunch here. Got a few more callers we want to get to. And if you need any further help with that or anybody else who would like to call the Apologist line, there's a phone number that you actually the main office number at Catholic Answers, 619-387-7200. And somebody can spend more time with you than any of the apologists can on the air. But glad that we could help you out with that. I'm Jerry Usher in for Cy Kellett today. And it just kind of struck me, startled me a little bit, because Lent is coming up so suddenly here upon us this year. March 6th is when Lent begins. So that's not too early to be thinking about what you're going to do by way of feeding your soul and growing in the knowledge of the faith and growing in the interior life as well. And Catholic Answers has a challenge. We're calling it the 20 Answers Challenge. Catholic Answers has a series of 32 books. They're digestible. They're not that big, easy to understand. And each one has 20 answers to various questions on spirituality, scripture, the sacraments, moral life, faith, prayer. A lot of areas are covered. And when you purchase the sampler of all 32 books in the series right now, you're going to save 60% off the regular price, and you're going to get free shipping if you live in the continental United States. And hundreds, Jimmy, have already signed up on this. I see no reason why we can't get that into the thousands before Lent starts.
That would be great.
Yeah. So you can do that right now. There are a couple of ways to do it. Go to the shop at Catholic.com, or you can call the customer service toll-free number 888-291-8000, 888-291-8000, or again, shop.catholic.com. But again, it's 60% off the sampler of all 32 books in the 20 Answers series. Take the challenge this Lent and Easter from Catholic Answers. More of your questions for Jimmy Akin are coming right up.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
He was a pope, a saint, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Pope St. Gregory I the Great is one of only four popes honored as the Great. Among his many achievements was sending missionaries across Northern Europe, especially St. Augustine of Canterbury, who brought Christ to the people of England. In a pun, Pope Gregory called the English people angels. He died in 604.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Pope Francis reminds us that it does not take a specialized degree in theology to become a great evangelist. We're all called to evangelize. Think about the woman at the well. After she encountered Jesus, she immediately went into the city and invited others to meet him as she had. You and I can go out now and do the same. And St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. Get involved today by contacting us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
We are in the home stretch of this Tuesday Q&A Open Forum program on Catholic Answers Live. Chrissy is next in Omaha, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Hi, Chrissy. Welcome.
What?
Hello, Chrissy.
Hello.
Hello, hi, you're Chrissy. On the air. What's your question, Chrissy?
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
What is the difference between Hades and hell?
Well, sometimes there's no difference. Sometimes people use Hades and hell as meaning exactly the same thing. And in contemporary English, that's a reference to the place of the damned specifically. However, that's not always been the case. Originally, both Hades or Hades in Greek and hell in English didn't refer to the place of the dead specifically. They referred to the place of the damned specifically. They referred in a more general way to the place of the dead, all of the dead, whether they were saved or damned or whatever. And so in Greek, originally, and this is true even in pre-Christian Greek, Hades or Hades just was the place of the dead. Didn't mean specifically the place where damned people go. That would be somewhere like Tartarus, which was a place of suffering in the Greek afterlife. In English, which developed out of the Germanic languages, hell originally, again, was just the place of the dead. That's why we talk about in the Creed, we say Jesus descended into hell. We don't mean he went to the place of the damned. We just mean he went to the place of the dead. He died. And that's what that's one of the key affirmations of what that line in the Creed means. Over the course of time, in English, hell took on the connotation of being the place of the damned specifically, and that kind of attracted since Hades was a synonym for hell, that kind of attracted the word Hades to also mean the place of the damned. But that's a modern English usage. And so when you have people today say Hades or hell, they usually mean the same thing. They usually mean the place of the damned. But we need to be aware when we're reading older documents like those of the New Testament or like those like the older translations of the Creed, that they don't always have that meaning, and they tend to be more a general reference to the place of the dead without respect to whether they're saved or lost.
Okay, Chrissy?
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thing.
Zeke is in Wichita, Kansas. He has us on the Catholic Answers Live app. Hi, Zeke. You're next with Jimmy Akin.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Zeke. How can we help you?
Hey, I was reading the Didache, and the last line about the Our Father is, "For thine is power and glory forever."
Mm-hmm.
My question is to me it's apparent that Protestants say that when they say they're Our Father,
right?
And Catholics do not, mm-hmm. in my experience. Is there any history on this?
Yeah, so what happened was, as far as most scholars believe today, based on the manuscript evidence, the Gospels in the New Testament did not originally include that line. It was a line that was used in some early Christian circles as illustrated by the Didache, but it wasn't there in the version that we find in the Gospels. The Lord's Prayer appears both in Matthew and in Luke, and in neither of those, according to most scholars, was that line there. But it was used early on, and it was used in the liturgy and things like that. And as a result of that, according to most scholars, scribes, when they were writing the Gospels, some of them were used to saying that line. And so when they were copying, say, Matthew, and they got to the Lord's Prayer in Matthew 6 and they were making their copy of it, they would be uncertain, do I include this line or not? Because I'm used to saying it, but it's not here in this manuscript I'm copying. And some of them ended up including it. And consequently, it ended up in some biblical manuscripts. And then those manuscripts were used as the basis for various Protestant translations in English, like the King James Version. And so as a result, Protestants have historically tended to use that line. Now, there's nothing wrong with that line. It's just the question of, is it there in the originals or not? And so it became common in Protestant circles because they would see it there in the King James. But in other Bibles, and this is true even of many Protestant Bibles today, you'll only find that in a footnote with an explanation that it appears this was not in the originals. And Catholics have tended to say the original version that was in Matthew's gospel rather than the augmented version.
Okay, Zeke, thanks for the call. We're going to try to get to a couple of others if we can, at least Joe in Pennsylvania watching on YouTube Live, Catholic Answers Live. Hi, Joe. You're on with Jimmy Akin. How are you?
All right. Hey, I'm great. Hope you guys are well. Thanks so much. Recently viewing the show, and I absolutely love it. I had a quick question. I'm a lifelong Catholic. I'm also a medical physician, and you know, I do take things somewhat skeptically.
Okay. Joe, just so you know, we're real close to the end of the show, so I need you to give me a question so I can give you a good answer.
Okay. All right. Well, I blessed my studio with holy water, and I was getting quite angry because of the abuse of children that happened in our diocese in Pennsylvania. And I challenged and I taunted the demonic. If they're going to go after children, then why don't they pick on someone their own size?
Ooh.
So I was angry. I was extraordinarily angry when I did it. And then next day, about 3:30 a.m., I hear a voice. There's a voice in the studio. It's not coming from anywhere. It's not a known language. It has cadence. It has syntax. It has intonations, is extraordinarily mocking and hateful.
Okay.
And it's a small studio. You know, I walk around, there's no one else here, and it's definitely language.
Okay. Right. And got that. So what happened and what's your question?
My question is it ever okay to challenge evil, to rebuke evil, to challenge the demonic in the face of great evil? And
this is something that is dealt with in the book of Jude. One of the things that Jude talks about is how even Saint Michael, in his conflict with the devil, did not directly rebuke the devil himself. Instead, he said, "May the Lord rebuke you." And so Jude holds that up as an example to us of how we should not simply be engaging in the sort of spiritual warfare where we ourselves are taking it upon ourselves to do direct combat with demonic forces. Instead, we need to rely on God's grace and recognize that it's ultimately God who is in control, and it's ultimately Him who defeats the devil rather than us.
So I guess I kind of made a big mistake then.
Certainly I would say if you heard this voice and it appeared to be demonic to you, then I would, you know, call a priest and ask him to come out and bless the place and pray the Saint Michael prayer yourself for protection. And I would encourage people not to attempt to directly engage the forces of darkness. They are more powerful than we are. We need to rely on God's protection.
Okay, Joe, thanks for the call. We'll keep you in prayer and go ahead and do what Jimmy said. Might be good to get a priest in there. Don and Nono and the others, we are not going to have time to get to any of you further. But Jimmy, man, 2 hours. Great job.
Thank you so much. Likewise, Jerry. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, I appreciate working with you and keep up the great work. And folks, don't forget that you can take advantage of the 20 Answers Challenge at Catholic Answers. Just want to make a quick reminder about this before we sign off the air. Lent begins on March 6th. There's plenty of time right now, but that window is closing. If you want to start right at the beginning of Lent and take the 20 Answers Challenge, Catholic Answers has a sampler of all 32 books in the 20 Answers series. And what that is it's different topics of the faith, all digested and boiled down to 20 very easy to understand, easy to memorize, and simple to share answers on whatever faith issue it is. When you buy all 32 of those, you're going to save 60% off the normal price right now and get free shipping in the continental United States. Now is a great time to do it. Customer service is open for a couple more minutes, 888-291-8000. But if you don't get in there and you don't get the phone answer, you can go to shop.catholic.com. I'm Jerry Usher, in for Cy Kellett. I will be back on Thursday and Friday. In the meantime, you can catch me and Debbie Giorgiani on Take 2 with Jerry and Debbie at noon and midnight Eastern Time, Monday through Friday. God bless.